This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
My friends over at Exodus are proud and extremely excited to release the much-anticipated Lyft 4K Ultra. This new standard camber, it's anything but standard. The Lyft 4K Ultra was created with elite trail cam users in mind. Dedicated dual image sensors allows for breathtaking photos and video quality by optimizing hardware capabilities for both day and night conditions. The native size 14 megapixel daylight dedicated image sensor is the largest to ever be used, providing astonishing photos and the best video quality to ever come from a trail camera. The native size 2 megapixel nighttime dedicated image sensor carries the largest pixel size to ever be used. Combined with the match lenses, maximize light gathering capabilities for remarkable no glow image and video. The all new 2S2P power system leverages rechargeable 18650 cells that boost superior battery life while reducing the overall expense of running the trail cameras throughout its lifespan. With a runtime of over 540 minutes of 4K video, you'll enjoy months of use from a single charge or easily a full season in photo mode. The Lyft 4K housing was created with effortless setup in mind, yielding a 2-inch no-glow internal LCD screen, allows for pinpoint setup and programming ease on those sunny days in the field. A built-in cable tunnel allows for device security and protection against SD card tampering and theft. The Lyft series has been the cornerstone for Exodus since their inception almost 9 years ago, and you can experience the next generation of their flagship standard camera right now. Use the code BTE4K to save $50 while supplies last. Support the podcast and support our friends at Exodus, and do yourself a favor and lock in the most advanced and durable camera the world has to offer. Go to ExodusOutdoorGear.com, use the code BTE4K to save $50 while supplies last. Now let's talk about Osseo Gear. It's a great option for whitetail hunters. They develop a premium line of bow hunting gear that will rival any other clothing on the market in quality. Plus, you got a lifetime warranty on anything you buy from Osseo, which is pretty nice. They have a super unique camo pattern and great technology in their garments to keep you comfortable in the stand. So visit asiogear.com, get you some premium hunting clothing. Gotta talk to you about Stealth Outdoors, makers of Stealth Strips. Stealth Strips really are a product that any hunter, whether you're a weekend warrior or a guy that hunts almost every day, really needs to take advantage of. Stuff absolutely deadens your gear to make it essentially noise-free. If you haven't checked out Stealth Strips yet, stop buying all the other crappy alternatives like the hockey tape and any other stuff you're trying to use to silence your gear. Get the good stuff. Get Stealth Strips. Visit stealthoutdoors.com. Pick you up some Stealth Strips. All my partners are linked in the description below. Go check them out. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Hope everybody's doing good this Friday morning. Everybody's sitting at work listening to us, probably, Jake.
Yeah, that's a good place to do it. Good place to do it, I suppose.
We have some members of the channel, and I did a members only live before this, and that's what half the people were just in a training at work or sitting at a desk. So I'm being real productive.
I mean, it's Friday, right?
Yeah, you don't do anything on Friday anyway, right? You wait till Monday.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
If you guys don't know, this is Jake from X's Outdoor Gear. Or you got the Land Podcast you host. Is there anything else you host? That's it, right? You guys got a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, we got. Yeah, I handled those two podcasts, and it's been so much fun. And you know, we're well over 300 episodes on the Exodus podcast, which is pretty crazy when you go back to think about it. And then over 100, and I think I just hit like 120 something for the Land podcast. So I've had a lot of conversations and I've enjoyed them all. And it's been kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, you guys, me and you were talking before we got on here about you guys hit over 100,000 subscribers on YouTube this year, or just whatever, a month ago, right? Not very long ago.
January.
Yep. You're like I said, I was telling you, you're kind of in the elite group of YouTube hunters, hunting shows that are over 100,000 subscribers.
Yeah, well, it's been a collective effort, and we have an excellent team, and we've been thankful enough to have really great guests to help us get to that milestone, and it's been fun along the way. But you know, I remember when we started, when I started Exodus, I think we maybe had like 20 subscribers or something, and I remember we did some content actually with Dan way back in the day. And it was during deer season. It probably was 2020 or 2019. I can't remember, but I remember in the tree stand, I just refreshed the YouTube studio. I don't know if they actually had the YouTube studio app at the time. I just been the YouTube app. We had 1,000 subscribers. Like, oh my gosh, we had 1,000 subscribers. I was like, wow. Oh my gosh, this is crazy. And then to look back and to get all the way to 100,000 is just a collective effort of everyone that's been willing to share their stories and information. So I've been really grateful for that.
I don't remember what it was. We were doing a hunt or something with, I think Chad came, and Dan was like, man, you guys were like 30,000 or something like that. He's like, man, they're really growing. They're going to pass me up. And I'm like, yeah, maybe one day. And yeah, you did. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you guys think? Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're right. It is crazy. And it's just like the one thing, like, I know you're growing your channel from, you know, started from zero and to where you're at today. I'm sure you remember that 1,000 milestone, that 10,000 milestone. And it's crazy how the first 1,000 is really hard. I would say the next 10,000 is extremely hard. And then from that, it does get a little bit easier thanks to YouTube algorithm.
Yeah. Right. It's what do you guys think is your best, like, I guess if you got give someone a tip for YouTube, like what was your strategy for growing, or how did you guys get to 100,000?
Have really great guests. Have really great content and information, and have a really great editing team. And we were thankful enough to have all three of those things. I would say that's the biggest thing. And everyone always wants to have that viral piece. And it's kind of hard sometimes to anticipate what will do really, really exceptionally well. And we have had a couple of videos do exceptionally well. And they're usually like deer centric. This is funny because everyone loves big deer, but you can add another layer to that. Big typical deer. Those are the things that I think really? Deer hunter just geeks out about. Yeah, because I don't know why that is, but the Rapala buck, one of that video that we did, I did a VO of a story of it, and that was a really good one. And then the general in Nebraska, that was another one. So for some reason, the typical bucks really strike a chord with everyone because they're just giant, beautiful animals.
Well, and you guys were like first to market with those, like, stories of these big bucks. Not first to market, because, you know, obviously there's North American whitetail and all that, but on the YouTube space, you guys really seem to figure that out pretty quickly. And you guys also like took a, so back in, like, I don't remember when it was, Jake, you probably remember because I missed it, but I don't know if it was like late 2022 into early 2023, there was like this push for YouTube shorts.
Yeah.
And if you put out good YouTube shorts, you just skyrocketed.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a big part of it too, honestly. I mean, even this last year, that was a big part of, cause here's the thing, like we've had so many conversations, and then not everyone watches a long form podcast, but you have some really sharp guests share some really cool information, and you can put it in 30 seconds. Seems to be a little bit more digestible to everyone, but yeah, it's been crazy to see how this platform's evolved and how much more sophisticated everyone's gotten. And I'm talking about the people that make it, and then also the people that consume the content. I mean, we've all gotten smarter, a lot smarter than five years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, and there's all kinds of, I mean, it's a very competitive area now too, because there's so many resources for creators to take advantage of to make things a little more streamlined, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I missed that. I mean, I missed that short push. I kind of, me and Dan were just doing this, and we didn't, you know, it wasn't our thing to put shorts out, you know. And we should have. I mean,
hindsight.
We do now. Yeah. We do now. But. And even this, like you said, the long form content, I think like 15% of my views on this channel come from the long form content. The rest is either clips or shorts.
Yeah.
I mean, the vast majority of people like to watch the specific titled clips that are 10 minutes long, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's a lot to ask for someone to commit an hour of their time or an hour and a half or 45 minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah. Something that's pertinent to them. Yeah. I'll watch a 10 minute video. I know that guy. I want to hear what
he says. Or, I'm interested in this topic. You know, that's some kind of micro topic that was inside of this broader topic in a podcast, you know? Mm-hmm. Anyways, whose idea was it for Whitetail Cribs at Exodus?
So I give Scott Buckley kind of the credit of the inception. So, I think it was 2019. Cameron and I were there and we were recording some in-person video podcast, which was not too many people were doing that in general at that time. And so we walked in to his house and his son's there and we're getting set up. He's like, well, I got to show you my deer. So he went through and told all the different stories and just an incredible, you could just tell how much passion he had about telling the stories. And, you know, I was hooked and sucked in to listen to the stories and kind of left like, man, we should just probably record that and call it Whitetail Cribs. And so that was, I give Scott, honestly, I would say he's the creator of it, whether he realizes it or not, but yeah. he was the person that's like, man, we got to do this. And
he was the inspiration for it.
Absolutely. And that's been such a cool thing. And that's something that, you know, kind of expanded beyond Exodus. There's so many people that know Whitetail Cribs or bring it up at trade shows or, hey, when's more episodes of Whitetail Cribs coming out? And it's been really cool just to see how other people have their trophy rooms or the stories or these unique stories, bucks, and it's kind of grew beyond whatever our wildest imagination could have been. It's just has been lightning in a bottle, and so we have more videos coming later this year. And so Cameron traveled all over the country for a while, and like there was rotations of groups that was going to record those episodes, and then we recorded like there was one year we did an episode every single week, which is just a lot, and getting guests, yeah. The logistics, and so we just shortened it, and we try to do, you know, 7 to 8 each year now, which is much more manageable, but I wish we could meet every diehard deer hunter and check out their crib.
Oh yeah, but I mean, just the amount of money you guys had to spend traveling and logistics of it had to be astronomical.
Yeah.
But anyways, kudos to you guys. I think in the as far as a product company goes and their YouTube channel, you guys are the blueprint for, you know, using that as a marketing tool and promoting. So
really appreciate that.
Yeah. All right, Jake, you started the Land Podcast. How many episodes? You said 100 and something now.
I think 120 something.
Yeah. What was your guys's, like, what was your inspiration for that? Cause you guys already had trail cam radio and I guess what was your inspiration for starting a Land Podcast?
Yeah. So, I mean, I got my real estate license 8 years ago when I was a senior in college, and throughout that process, number one, I was really hungry for information just to learn as much as possible from everyone. You know, kind of the similar type of person that wants to learn more about hunting the big woods or hunting specific types of terrain features for deer hunting. And what I found was there's a lot of people that wanted to buy land. They didn't know how to do it. They didn't know if it was attainable. And the other thing too is once I had some clients that had done a lot of deals over years and then talked to a guy that's trying to buy his first farm, there was just a huge delta of information. And there's people that were hungry to learn. Really, the birth of it was I've always wanted to own land ever since I was a kid. And that's kind of why I got my real estate license, to try to find a way to be around it and make some extra money. And then just through the Land Podcast, like simply to educate people and ultimately inspire as well, I think is the big thing that has unintentionally happened to some regard, of inspiring people and showing that, hey, here's this person that has a similar career, probably similar situation, and he was able to save up some money and buy a piece of ground. And it's been a great investment. He's enjoyed it. His family's enjoyed it, and all those intangible things that necessarily don't show up in the bank account, but, you know, fill up the heart. And, so that's just kind of what ultimately birthed it. I remember I had that idea for a while, and then I recorded 2 episodes, and I'm just like, oh, I don't know, like, how am I gonna have time? And, you know, just kind of talking myself out of it. And then there was this one day I was like, I'm just going to publish it, and I'm going to release an episode every week. And that's kind of what's happened since.
Yeah. I've listened to quite a few of them. It's always super interesting to hear those guys' takes on land and like how just their mindset of like, I think it's, well, maybe we'll talk about this a little bit, but like, you know, people think about land and they think about it as a huge cost or which it is, but like, they don't think of it as an investment all the time. They think of it as like a hindrance on them, you know, like, mm-hmm. I can't do this because of this. It's like, well, you know, you're putting how much in your 401k, you could put a little bit of that in land, you know, things like that. So like in your opinion, Jake, how realistic is it for an average guy that makes, you know, maybe you're doing well and you're making $70,000 a year or something at your job and, or, and, you've got a wife and a kid or something like that. Like how realistic is it anymore for a guy, a normal guy to buy a chunk of land to deer hunt on?
It's definitely harder. It's definitely harder than what it was 20 years ago. And it'll definitely be harder 20 more years in the future. So I'd say right now is probably a great time, but for anyone that's in that position, I think it's ultra realistic. I think you're going to have to make sacrifices in some form or fashion in your life. I think you probably aren't going to need two car payments in your household, or better yet, have zero car payments in your household. I think that, you know, this is something that I shared on the podcast a couple weeks ago, but $20 a day. So lunch money, right? $20 a day. If you can save that a day, that's $10,000 that you just found. And so it's just those little sacrifices in order to save up on a down payment. Because I think that's probably the biggest hurdle for most people is saving up a down payment. I think you can, if you can find a second source of income, cut some costs, save some additional money, and just create some form of margin in your life. Because it's not easy, because if it was easy, everyone would own land. And so I pulled a kind of nerdy. I pulled out, there's like through the census on a website, I was able to filter through my county. And I wanted to see how many people in my county own over 40 acres. 3%, 3% of people that live in this county own over 40 acres. So 40 acres to some people is a lot of land. But even to get to that point, you are, you know, 3 out of 100 in order to do that. But I think it is attainable for everyone to do it. And that's the one interesting thing, or one of the interesting things with the land podcast is a lot of these guys that, let's say a guy that owns 2,000 acres, he probably started with a 40. Or another guy that started with a 10 and then went to a 20 and then went to a 40. And to me, it's just, you have to get started. You have to save up the money. I think to put a little self pressure, like if this is something you want to do, I'd put a 2-year timeline. 2 years, I'm going to save up as much as money as possible. And then I'm going to try to go find a piece of ground to buy. And because I think if you wait, it just doesn't happen. It's the first step's the hardest, and saving up some money and getting, I mean, we can dive into all the details of what to do before you start shopping for land, but it's 100% attainable. It's just making sacrifices and making it a priority. I truly feel that. I mean, we've had school teachers on here on the land podcast that bought a piece of ground. I mean, so they're public servants in reality, like they don't make a bunch of money, but he was able to save up some money and buy a piece of ground. And I think it's possible. It's the original American dream, but it is attainable.
Yeah. Yeah. It does feel like it. Like, and I think maybe as a consumer of land, like not me, I don't, I mean, I got like six acres here, you know, but you often hear like around the watering hole, like, oh, Farmer John bought the 500 acre piece for a couple $1 million or whatever it is, you know, and it just, you hear those numbers and it just like, it's almost overwhelming. Like, for a deer hunter, is there like a specific type of land you would look for? Or you know, just, you're not competing with a farmer or someone like that.
No, that's a great question. I think there's a couple different types. I mean, some people just like to hunt timber. So, I mean, obviously timber typically isn't going to crank out a bunch of annual returns. So maybe you're looking at something with a little less, I think the perfect first farm in my mind is, let's say it's 40 acres and it's 15 acres tillable. It has crop history. If you want to cash rent it, you can cash rent it. If you want to just put it in the food plots, you can put it in food plots. Or if you want to own it for a year and then enroll it into CRP and get some form of income, because farmers aren't going to compete on chopped up tillable. They got big equipment now, and you know,
they want a 100 acre field.
Exactly. Yeah. And the thing of it too is it's funny, where I'm at here in Illinois, there's some really good dirt, and what someone in Western Nebraska would die for to farm. Yeah. You couldn't get a farmer to farm here. And so you have to put that back into perspective, because they're like, oh, that dirt's terrible. And it's like, so what's it do? 50 bushel beans? And they're like, yeah, well, you know, I can do 65 or 70 on this piece and it costs twice as much. And so I think that's kind of a frame of reference you have to get into. And I think something that has a little bit of income is a great, great thing. And it also boils down to your goals. Like, maybe you want a 40 that's all timber and you can build a little cabin and it's 4 hours away from your house. So, I mean, there's so many different things, but the biggest thing is, I think a lot of people get paralyzed on their first farm. It has to be perfect. It has to have this, and then they never buy anything. Like, just buy an okay farm. At that point, you're going to learn what you really want and what you really don't want. And I think it's the same. This is the same parallel that I think a lot of people can relate to is you hear the term starter home, like maybe it's a 3-bedroom, 1-bath or 2-bedroom, 2-bath or whatever it is. It's a place to get started. And then you live there, you pay down the mortgage, you maybe make some improvements, and then your family grows. And then you sell it, you take that equity and go into a house that is quote unquote your forever home or the next one. And I think farms are kind of similar. Like we all dream of the, you know, the square 640, but you're not going to buy your square 640 as your first farm. And you're not going to buy a 5,000 square foot house as your first house too. So it's kind of the same parallel.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Cause I'm probably guilty of that. I never think about like, you know, whenever I envision me buying a farm, it's like this perfect, like, you know, Bill Winkie's right. Dream farm type thing. It's like, wait a minute. Bill's probably owned dozens of pieces of property, you know, to get to where it is or whatever. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he was part of we interviewed him 21, I think it was, and we got his full story, which is on the Exodus YouTube channel and also on the Land Podcast too. But he started with $12,000 to be a member of a big group. And that's how he got in there. And then he worked on it and then he sold his shares and then went and bought a piece of ground. So it's like, this is the only concrete way to get started, and it's to simply start. I mean, yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah. I have a guy that lives down the road from me. His name is Brad Herndon. He wrote the book Mapping Trophy Whitetails. But he is like really, really good friends with Bill Winkie. And I didn't know that. I was over at his house the other day. He's also a photographer. So he's like teaching me some photography stuff. And, we got to talking, and him and Bill had a business together even in the outdoor industry where they took pictures.
For articles. About that. Yeah. He talked about that.
Yeah. So I won't get into the details of the business exactly, but essentially they take pictures for writers to use in their magazine articles. And then, you know, they have sponsorships for it and everything else. But I was like, oh, I'm kind of a fan of Bill Winkie. He's one of the guys that I do watch on YouTube, and he's kind of an OG in that space.
Yeah. Likewise. I think he's the inspiration for a lot of people of our age to own land. Cause you can see what he built over his lifetime. And he's so relatable. It's like, man, you know, like Bill did, you know, it's like, it's not like he's on a high horse of like, I did this because I'm special. Like, I did this because I worked hard and you can do it too, which I think is really cool.
Well, his story, and maybe I'm wrong here, like a lot of these guys that have these big TV shows that we know of, you know, all the big name guys, a lot of them have their own gigantic business on this that they, you know, they're doing this on the side. And it seemed like Bill, maybe I'm wrong, but was more of a normal guy and kind of did it that way. But, or they're big farmers, you know, some people are just big farmers. And then I was a big fan of them too, but or still am. I don't watch much of it anymore. But Don and Candy Kiske,
yeah,
you know, I always liked watching their stuff. I think they're pretty large farmers.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's for sure. But there's also a lot of people do have, once again, two streams of income, and usually the one outside of land is bigger. But
just outside of the hunting industry is bigger
for sure. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, there's a lot of people I've met that, you know, have a very relatable job or relatable income. And I think that's something we all get paralyzed is, you know, we're in chapter one, right? Like if you haven't bought a piece of ground yet, you're in chapter one and you're comparing yourself to guys that have been doing it for 20 years, 25 years. And I think that could be, it could be paralyzing. Like, man, I'll never get there, but you just have to get started. I mean, that's just, it's just like anything.
How small is too small, do you think, to like invest in? Like when's is there like a threshold where it's like, okay, you got to have this much land for it to be a good investment?
Man, I hate to be the it depends guy on podcasts because I hate when people do that to me. But I would say it's very dependent on your goals. But I mean, I think a 20 is a good place to start. If you had 10 acres that butted up to a landfill, for example, then I'd say 10 acres is plenty to get you started and a place to hunt. And, you know, so I think 20 is a great place to start. And I think, you know, that 20 probably isn't going to be your last piece, but it's going to be your first piece and you're going to learn a lot. And you just have to dip your toe in it. You have to, you know, make a plunge. But I think there's a lot of resources to get sharp before you're not going into it blindly anymore, I think, because there's so much good information out there.
All right. Let's start from the beginning. Like you mentioned earlier, what to do if you're wanting to buy a piece. Like, what's their first steps? Like, what does a guy like me, if I want to go buy a 40, where would you start?
I would say, number one, save up your down payment. That's just to figure out a good savings plan. And maybe a good way to practice to see if you can afford it. Maybe you think you want to spend, let's say, $1,000 a month on a payment. And so maybe you make that your forced savings $1,500 a month until you get to the down payment. So you kind of have a forced, like, there's not going to be a bunch of life adjustment because you've already been doing that for, let's say, a year or two. I think that's a good piece. And then the other thing is finding a good lender. When I was fresh out of college, this is kind of a crazy story. I went to go get a truck. I was dumb. I wasn't going to go buy a truck. I needed a loan to buy it. And this bank, my local bank, would not lend to me because I didn't have any job history and everything else. And I'm like, gosh, dang it. And they said I was good, right? And I'm so like, I went and bought the truck. Truck sitting at my house. And they're like, yeah, we can't do it. And I'm like, what the heck? You know, like, all right, this is kind of embarrassing. So then I called another bank. They're like, they gave you a hard time. And I'm like, yeah. How much are you putting down? This much? They're like, oh, you're good. I was like, you don't, like, there's nothing else? They're like, no, you're good to go. Just come on in, pick up a check and buy the truck. And that story right there illustrates, call multiple banks because different banks are going to lend you different things. There's different terms. There's a really good lender here in Illinois that I do a lot of business with, and they're extremely great to work with. Their rates are very competitive. So, I mean, just because you Google, you know, what is a land loan interest rate? There's going to be variance if you call multiple lenders. And when you're looking at buying something, if you can shave off 0.2% or 0.3%, that's a big difference on the monthly payment. And so I think that's really important, is to shop for a lender, find someone that you can talk to, someone that's going to teach you the process too. Like, hey, you know, like these, that's what these people do every single day, right? And so they're going to tell you some things to look for and ultimately just be someone in your corner. So I think save a down payment, find a good lender. And the other one's find a good agent too. So a buyer's agent, how it's structured, if it's listed, the seller pays for the commission. So you can have a buyer's agent. It's not going to cost you anything. And so you want someone that has done a lot of transactions and can be in your corner and can look at all these different things and ultimately provide a service that you don't have to pay for. So I think that's another really important thing. Just call some agents, find one you jive with well, explain kind of what you're looking for, and stay in their corner too and say, hey, do you have anything coming down the pipeline? Hey, this is what I'm looking for. Hey, what do you think of this piece? I found it online. I think that's, for someone just getting started out, that's a really good piece of advice.
What do you think about all these, like, I mean, there is so many of them, these, like, I don't know what you properly would call them, like these deer hunting real estate agents, you know, like, is that the only way to go as a deer hunter now? Or is that kind of a market that's, is it causing the deer properties to be elevated because they're labeled that way, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the market will dictate what something is worth. So imagine like, just say a Premier Farm, right? And you have someone that doesn't know all these intrinsic values of this unique piece. And then you do have a guy that does understand that. I could see how that would, you know, force a higher price. But I think there's a lot of people too that you just got to find someone that has the heart of a teacher and knows just enough for, like, on the, you know, can bounce ideas around from a deer hunting perspective, is probably a good place to be than the local real estate agent that, you know, doesn't really know much about recreational ground. And I mean, honestly too, even like, there's some really good tillable agents that understand tillable and farmland very well, and they don't understand recreational well. And then there's the inverse of that too. So just whatever you're looking for, find a true expert in that field, someone that has some deals under their belt and someone that's willing to take the time to teach you too, I think is just ultra important. But it is a weird space. I remember, like, some of the guys that we talked to, the land podcast that, you know, was buying ground in the 90s. And then it was what we see, it was in its infancy of what we see today. Like, there's so many specialized agents and specialized brokerages. It's crazy. And there's more every day, it feels like.
Oh, you just, like, drive down the road in some rural county somewhere and, like, all the billboards are, like, I don't know, hunting land, real estate. And I just all kind of, like, what are all these? Are there's like a million of these companies. I used to just be like, Whitetail Properties. That was the only one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And now there's so many localized and regionalized brokerages, but, I don't know. I often wonder, like, is it good for the space, or is it bad for the space? Or and I also think it's like a current that it's going to, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Like, life will move on without your opinion.
It, you're probably right. I mean, I think when people are spending that much money on something, they're not going to, you know, they're going to have their homework done usually and going to pay for what it's worth. Not necessarily, you know, as a seller, even, you're going to want to have whatever label you put on your land. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So you're not going to do something stupid and undervalue your land. All right. So we kind of talked about getting the land and the process of that. What about selling land? Like, when's a good time to sell your land?
That's a good question. I would say for recreational ground, I think now's a pretty good time. I typically would say there's a lull in the middle of the summer because most people don't want to go out and walk a farm in the middle of the summer with bugs and ticks. And so I think I would say after season to spring, and I would say June, July is slow. And then I would say August would be another good time because the next buyer could potentially buy it and still hunt it yet that fall and maybe get early possession to put in food plots or something. So I would say those are the key times, but you know, a lot of sellers that have different motivations too. Maybe they found something closer to home and they need to sell it now. And that's when they're going to list it. So it's kind of dynamic, but I would say the off season is best. And I think if you're a diehard deer, it's sometimes really hard in late summer to really look at sign. I think sometimes it's a benefit right now to look at a piece that before all the green up and really see what it looks like and get an idea. And also it could be misleading if you go walk a piece in the third week of November and the place is on fire and you're like, oh man, this place is amazing.
True. You know,
so I would say that's some things to consider, but I'd say sell a good time to sell is when you need to, or, you know, late winter, early spring.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. We were out, I hunted out in Kansas this last season, and there was a farmer that let us stay in this little log cabin he has at his on one of his farms. Kind of one of those deals where he bought a farm and it had a log cabin on it, so he fixed it up. And he was telling me that around where he's at in Kansas, that the hunting land has just like skyrocketed almost to what the you know, it used to be trash land that wasn't worth anything. Oh geez, one second, Huck, go eat your mom. Please. No, buddy. And he was saying like trash land that used to, nobody would give a dime for is now selling for more than, you know, his farmland. And they've sold some stuff just because it's like, holy hell, you want this for that amount of money. And they, you know, start hunting camp with it.
Mm-hmm. That trend's happened across the Midwest and now it's in Kansas and it is crazy. And I think that there's a lot of interest in Kansas for a lot of reasons. And I read a report, and actually Kansas in terms of the Midwest had the highest amount of appreciation out of all the Midwest states over the last few years. And it was
okay.
Like annualized return of 20% or something. There's something crazy. So and I get it too, because hunting in Iowa this past year on the way home, I'm thinking, man, I want to do this again, but I don't want to wait 5 or 6 years. And then, so what's the next thought in my head? Well, Kansas. Because if you own an 80, you can go, or if you buy something less than 80, you can hopefully draw that archery tag every other year.
Right. Let me, there's a couple questions in here. Let me let you get to them, and then I'm going to go take Huck to his mom real quick. But the first one is from Uno Dos Trace. He said, would you buy land that has CWD in the area? And then he also asked, what's your top improvements on a new property? I'm going to go get Huck. You take those so we don't have a lull on the podcast.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Great questions. I would probably not be too spooked to buy something in a CWD area just because there's so much unknown right now. I know in Missouri, for example, some of those areas you can't do supplemental feeding in the off season. And so I think that trend's probably going to continue. But I would say that's probably boils down to a personal decision more so than anything. But CWD and EHD is not my expertise, but it is something that is getting a lot more attention. And then in terms of top improvements, I think number one, a lot of more people are getting more sophisticated when it comes to buying land. And I think that buying something with whatever a piece that you can look at a piece and say, what is the lowest hole in the bucket and what can I do to fix it? And I think that's probably typically the best answer on what's the best improvement you can do. And whether that's improving access, put in a culvert where you can access a different part of the farm. There's just a bunch of different things, but I would say some sort of way to navigate more to the farm than what there is today is probably the easiest and best improvement.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm assuming you just answered that second question there.
Yeah.
Yep. Do you feel like a mistake a lot of guys make when they buy a piece of land for hunting is that they do mess around with it too much, or is there always stuff to be doing on a piece of land?
Man, that is I'm going to give you the perfect world answer. You have a farm that you buy and never step foot on, and then you have your farm that you want to tinker on because it is addicting and you want to go out and, you know, you spend a lot of money on it. You want to go out there and enjoy it. But I think a lot of people are their worst enemy when they buy a piece, because they think they have to do all these different things. And then they go back and hunt a permission piece that they haven't stepped foot on, haven't paid a lick attention to other than cameras. And the permission piece is better than the piece that they bought because they're messing around on it all the time. So I do think there's a point of diminishing returns for sure. And I know I'm guilty of that, because I mean, I like just to go work on the land. I like to plant trees. I like to do, you know, I just like to tinker. And so, yeah, I do definitely think people do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see me being that way. I'd probably buy a dang tractor and be out there tinkering around all the time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I love it. And it's a trade-off, but I do think that's probably a shortcoming. But I mean, if you know, that's the thing, like every piece is a little bit different too. Like if you just have a quote unquote rut farm, well, it's probably not that impactful, but
right.
If you can't let deer live on your farm because you're out there messing around all the time, that might be a problem. But
yeah. Let's talk about your land, Jake. How did you acquire your, where you're at right now? How'd you acquire it? And like, what are some improvements you've made that you've seen benefits from?
Yeah, I bought two pieces now, and bought my first farm when I was 26, and I was saving up money, waiting. And it was a farm that is ugly. It's an ugly farm. I'm gonna be the first person to tell you that, but it's the reason I could afford it. And so I saved up my money, and man, I was so nervous. I was 26. Didn't have hardly any money, but just enough to buy it, right? But I was like, you know, I was just like, man, I just have to do it. Like, okay, what's the worst case scenario? I was like, well, that's not that bad. And like, worst case scenario, I'll sell it.
Yeah.
And so it was listed for sale, and went and bought it, and it's been such a great decision. I think this is something that a lot of people grapple with, is do I want to buy this because something else better might come along? And honestly, in my area, there's not a lot of inventory typically. And I felt like I haven't missed out on anything. I bought the best farm that I could afford. And so that's what I felt, you know, comfortable with. And so now this would be the third year. This summer will be the third year that I've owned it. And so did a lot of different projects. Did some this is another thing I've learned too from the Land Podcast, is a lot of these guys that they see what projects need to be done and they just do them, right? And it took me some time to realize, like, these are some projects in the back of my mind of like, I need to do these, but I was too cheap to do it or not confident enough to write the check and have it done. And so this past summer, I actually put in a updated road system, dozed out a food plot, moved some blinds around, and it made a big difference in terms of how the farm hunted. And ironically, I hate hunting out of blinds. Like, I truly hate hunting out of blinds, but I did move a blind because there was no other tree. And the first time I was in there, I shot a buck I wanted to shoot, you know? So it's like, I dozed in a road to make better access. And then I hunted out of it and shot the deer I wanted to. And I was like, wow, that actually worked. All these plans and all these things that I knew I should have done the first year I bought it, I finally did it and it worked. And so that's something that is kind of a hard thing. I was like, in my 20s, like, that's a lot of, you know, like all these things,
right? Yeah.
That's a lot. Like, where do you draw the line? But it was something I'm really glad I did. And the farm's much better because of that. And at my house, I put in some CRP, and then I planted a bunch of trees. I'm going to continue to plant a bunch of trees, and I'm getting rid of invasives. And this is something that once you buy your own ground, it's like, you can always learn a bunch about deer hunting, right? Like, there's always things you can learn and test and implement. But when you start looking at all these other different nuanced things, I like learning. There is so much more to learn. Like, having biologists out there and they're telling you about this plant, why this plant's good, why this plant's bad, or I would try to do this. And so I've been getting rid of a bunch of invasives and trying to get natives back in there. And become way more environmentally conscious than what I ever dreamed of. And now it's kind of, I feel like a darn hippie out back.
Look at all the butterflies out here.
Right. It's like all these things I would have never cared about. And I'm like, oh, wow, there was a pheasant on the farm. I mean, you know, it's like before I wouldn't have cared, but it's like, wow, the habitat, there's a pheasant. There's never been pheasants here. And so it's kind of like all these weird things that you can't really explain until you have your own piece and you start doing these projects. But man, it's addicting. And I just love all the different things that you can learn. Like, okay, I want to plant switchgrass. Okay, now I have to learn about all these different ways, how to prep it and how to get in the ground. Or I want to plant trees. When's the best time to do it? Do you tube them? Do you not tube them? What species do you plant? What soil types are good for this? And so it just opens up a whole new can of worms of stuff to learn. TSI, it's addicting, man. It's so addicting. That way more addicting than what I could ever really even imagine. And it's so much fun.
So these, all the improvements you made, like, you get that out of the value of your land at the end of the day, like you're investing back into your land. Does that typically raise the value of your land or not?
I would say for the right buyer, absolutely. And I think some of the major infrastructure improvements that you can do are, you'll definitely get the value back out of it. Now, planting a bunch of trees, I'm just doing that because I want to, because I think it's cool. But like improving, you know, access or a road system or putting in a pond or something like that, I do think you'll get a return. I'm not saying you're going to 2x your money for what you put into it, but I think you'll get in what you paid for at a minimum, or it'll make it just easier to sell down the road. Which another thing you'll learn is the first piece you buy, you fall in love with, man. Like, it's hard to sell that because you worked really hard and you remember all the sacrifices you made. And then it's like, man, you know, it's like
nostalgic.
You become kind of emotionally attached to it. And that's something that I haven't sold them yet, but it's like, but then you talk to everyone else. It's like, yeah, you have to sell it to get to the next one. And I'm not there quite yet, but it's crossed my mind for sure. But the short of it is, if you do strategic improvements, I think you can definitely do it. But I mean, buyers are a lot more sophisticated, right? I mean, I talked to a couple years ago, no one even really cared about people, less people cared about certain things. Like, for example, there's some guys I know, like, I'm only going to buy a farm that has an east road going down it so I can access it on a predominantly west wind. And so people are getting a lot more sophisticated, but they say that, but there's just not a lot of farms available too. And that's where, even going back to when I bought my first farm, I'm thinking, you know, what if the market crashes, or what if this happens? Or at that point, this was right when land was starting to go up, and they're like, oh man, that's really expensive, but just buy it and time will be on your side. And over, you know, a course of 3 or 5 years, it's going to be worth more historically. I mean, historically, the land market has not been nearly as volatile as other forms of investments. And so it's a very steady, rock solid investment. So I found comfort in that too. So it's twofold: improve it and ride the storm, whatever that is, or ride the wave.
I think that's why farmers are so good at land. Their tolerance for risk is so, they're so callous to risk. Because they invest so much money into fertilizer and into, spraying and just diesel fuel. I mean, seed prices, like, it's shocking when you hear like a guy that farms 5,000 acres, how much money goes through his hands in a year. And like a normal guy like me and you, we can't even fathom that happening, you know? And to them, it's just like, well, yep. Like,
right. Yeah. I mean, corn prices are a good example of that. You know, like, we're looking at a high $4 corn this year, and it was substantially more in 2022. And you put a multiple on that. Yeah, it's crazy. But I think those farmers also realize that the land has been some of the best investments that they've done. And that's where, I mean, it's, you know, I'm not saying this is right, but I just, even locally, I'll ask people like that I know that did not start with land and now they have a lot of land. How'd you do it? And like, well, I just bought a crappy piece, made it better, and then bought another piece. Yeah. Like, what's your other forms of investment? Like, it's land. I don't trust the stock market. I don't understand it, but I understand land. It's like, I get that. Cause I mean, you can go put money into a company that you have no control of. You're just parking your money there. You have no control of it. You're not the CEO. You're not anything. You're just riding however they perform. But in land, you can go out, look at it, see what you can do, and you can control those improvements and you can make it better, where you can't do that with a lot of other forms of investment too. So that's another thing that I think is just attractive for a lot of people too.
Yeah. Yeah. I had when I was younger, I lived in a different town. I had a farmer that let me hunt his 200 acres. He had 200 acres that he lived on. And he was like, he bought it like in 78 or something like that, 79. And he was young. He was in his early 20s. And he just got married. And he's like, I remember like laying at night in a pool of sweat, like thinking like, how am I ever going to pay for this land? And he said it was something stupid, an acre, like $200 an acre right. back then, you know? And now that farm's worth, who knows how much, you know, probably $10,000 an acre. Mm-hmm. But he's like, people think that was cheap back then, but it felt just like you'd be buying land right now. It felt like I'm never going to be able to financially recover from this, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, there was even another farmer that I know that, you know, owns quite a bit of ground. And I was talking to him. He's like, I remember I was the first person to pay $10,000 an acre for tillable around here. And everyone thought I was stupid. And then that same field is probably worth $17,000, $18,000, $19,000, you know, 10 years later or whatever it is, 10, 12 years later. And he's like, well, I look pretty smart now. And I think that's just the epitome of real estate, of like buying it right. That's the other thing too. Everyone hears the crazy story from their cousin's aunt's brother that bought blah, blah acres for dollar, you know, whatever, because of this really strange deal.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, that's cool. If you can fall into that, it's just super rare, but most people, they just buy something at a fair price and improve it and use it. And like, that's the basis. Cause I think that's another thing, is like, even the stock market, like, oh, I'm going to wait for this giant crash and then I'm going to invest a bunch of money. You're probably not, cause you're scared, because you think it's going to go to zero. Right.
So it's crashing.
Yeah. And it's just like, everyone thinks they have this, you know, callous psychology when it comes to investing. And I don't think 99% of people don't. That's why, not to get super nerdy, but that's why mutual fund, like a good S&P 500 index, outperforms most managed funds. Like, so these people are getting paid to manage funds and they don't even beat the S&P 500. So it's like, those are the smartest people on earth that are most in tune with business.
Yeah.
They can't even beat the index.
But it's not, yeah. But it's not sexy. It's not buying GameStop stock.
Right, exactly. You know. Yeah. Exactly. That's what people want. Whatever. Yeah. They want the Dogecoin.
4,000% left.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. 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 It's like the amount of people that actually made money on that is like very minuscule, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess it's the same case with land. It's just it just is what it is. I guess, I think you summed it up the best. It's like, the best time to buy is right now, because I don't know. But people don't want to hear that, because right now it's expensive. You know, it's like, gosh.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, is you'll look back 20 years ago and say, why didn't I buy that? Oh my gosh. Are you kidding me? And it's just, time marches on and you're going to thank yourself if you get locked in. And I, you know, maybe before I got started, I don't know if I would have that answer, but I've been able to interview a lot of people that have been doing it for a long time. And that's the common theme. I mean, this is not my opinion. This is what I've gathered from talking to people way smarter than me that's been doing it for way longer. And I think you buy when you can afford something, and buy something solid. And it's that simple. I think we overcomplicate things.
You've talked to a lot of people on the land podcast. Now, who's been your favorite interview, or can you give some people, like, people want to go and check out a couple of these interviews? Who would you want to, you'd recommend?
Man, there's a lot of really good ones. I'll tell you that I have one talking about, just, it's kind of the same theme what we're talking about. It's going to get released here in a couple of weeks. It's this is the outlier of some of the guests, but it was a father and son. Father had a good job, moved back to the family farm when he was, you know, a young professional with a young family, and bought some ground. His dad bought some ground, went completely bankrupt. They had 3 years of bad crops, went completely bankrupt, lost everything. And they lost everything. And I've been wanting to hear that story of someone that, you know, land did not work out for him, which was the 80s farm crisis, which was very bad for a lot of people. But then how the story works out, though, is they were able to buy back the original farm in 2007 at an auction. So that's just kind of a cool story. And I'm really thankful that those people shared their struggles, because I think it's something good to hear. But there's a bunch of really great episodes. I mean, Flint Koch is one. He has bought a lot of ground, and he, you know, had a tree trimming business, and he sold that and he started buying residential real estate, and has built a portfolio. Skip Sly is another great one. He talks about just getting started, because he just got started too. And he has, you know, an impressive holding in real estate as well. Steve Hansen is another one. Steve, you'll appreciate this. Steve Hansen's first farm he bought, kind of the same motion that I was talking about, except it was a lot bigger. He's in his 20s. He bought, I think it was 123 acres in Monroe County, Iowa. And you know who he sold that farm to? Bill Winky. He sold it to Bill of all people, and that was just like a crazy story that he bought it, and then it adjoined what Bill was building together, and so like that played into the story of Bill building his dream farm. So that was a really cool story. And then, I mean, there's just so many different. Some of the first time land buyers episodes are some of my favorite too, because it's just guys that are sharing their story of how they did it. So I think those are some key ones. There's some really good ones with lenders too. If you're not very familiar with how that works, there was one with Joe Cater. He's from Missouri, and he talks through the lending process. I think that was a really good episode. So, I mean, there's a bunch, and I think no matter what, you're going to find one, whatever situation you're in, you're going to find one that's relatable, or you're going to be able to peek into someone's brain that's been doing it for 20 or 30 years too, which is extremely valuable.
Yeah. I've listened to quite a few of them. They're always, of course it's a topic that I'm interested in, so I'm always sucked in whenever people start talking about land. Ray's right. He had a comment about his dad buying timberland back in 93, and the aerial map said it was labeled as wasteland, and he bought it for 300 an acre back then. But what are your thoughts on timberland? Like, is that a good thing to look at, or is timberland that's, you know, cuttable, I guess, is it typically like a premium?
It depends on who has it listed, I would say. And also, I mean, it's,
oh really?
Yeah, I mean, I would say this. I mean, if you're in the South, that's, it's a little bit different because their timber values are different, and there's like tree plantations. But I would say for the Midwest, it could definitely be a great opportunity. I think one shortcoming that a lot of people have is that are getting started is they want to buy it and then cut whatever marketable timber is there. And I don't know if that's the best strategy. I really don't, because those trees exponentially get more valuable as they get bigger. And so like if you cut I've had multiple loggers that also deer hunt explain it as, you can shoot a 3-year-old 150-inch deer, or you can wait for them to get to 5 and let them get to 200. And trees are kind of the same deal. So that's something to really consider. Like once you cut an oak, that might be a 100-year-old tree, and that's a 100-year decision. So I think that's something you need to talk to some loggers. You need to find a really good forester is probably what I would say. And I would think of this as more conservation minded than trying to extract every dollar possible out of a piece, because there's a lot of pieces that have been degraded over the years, and it's harder to find good timber. And I think that that's the hippie of me talking now, because I think people get too aggressive cutting really, you know, trees that should stay longer, maybe another 15 years, but they would rather make $1,000 now than wait and pass that on to the next person, because that value is there no matter what. And if you find a way to market that properly and say, hey, there's $50,000 of timber on this piece, we have not cut it, and that value is there, and it'll continue to grow. So I think you can get that value back out without actually cutting the trees, in my opinion. And it's going to grow during that process that you have it. So I think consulting a good forester, and the timber market's very confusing. And I think it's very confusing on purpose too. So people can't figure it out. Yeah. It's very, I mean, there's always stories of people that, the best way, if you're going to do a timber sale, in my opinion, you've never done one before, is to get a forester in there, walk it with them, mark the trees together, explain what your goals are. And then that forester is going to send out that bid to loggers to bid on those jobs for the trees. And there'll be a wide variance in value. Like you could have one guy offer you 20 grand. You might have another guy offer 80 grand. And so that's these are very big decisions. And that's why you have to have someone that is an expert in your corner, in my opinion. So it's very complex, and I know a lot more than I did 2 years ago, but it's the classic, the more you know, the less you do. And so I'm not going to speak on it like I'm an expert. And so I would say consult the forester. But I do think that's a great way to find hidden value. Absolutely. It's definitely a great way to find hidden value in a piece like that.
Yeah. It almost seems like maybe a shortcut that doesn't need to be taken sometimes, though. Like you buy it and you cut all the timber off of it right away to get some of your money back. And I don't know. In certain scenarios, it's good. And if you need to, but I always just cringe when I see it. Just around here, man, every tree line and every wood lot is just getting bulldozed in. And I'm just like, gosh, man, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you this. I walk a lot of farms, right? And I would say there's maybe one out of 12 farms that I actually say like, wow, this place wasn't cut aggressive in the 70s, and it's never been manned since, and there's no young oaks. It's this old junk.
Yeah.
And it's so sad.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's only so much old growth. I saw a map of old growth that's still existing in the United States. And it just looks like specks. Like there's very, very little. So I think if you do find a piece like that, you need to be a steward of the land. And obviously those trees will eventually rot and die. So you want to get some value out of them if they're on, you know, at the end of the life, but it's a personal decision, but that's my opinion on it. And it's complex. So I would say talk to a forester and learn that. And it's just, you would think like, some things are like, okay, corn is $4.80 a bushel, right? It's just, that's what it is. But you look at a tree and it might be a really valuable tree when you talk to one person, or another person's going to beat you up and say, well, there's that one knot there. And so it's just extremely dynamic. And so if you think you know a lot, I would talk to some more people and you might learn that you don't. That's what I would say.
I have a really good forester that lives just down the road here from me. His name's Rob Hobry. He helped Mark Kenyon with the Back 40.
Mm.
I don't remember that show.
Yeah.
They did that, and he came up there, I think, and helped Mark with the timber and trees planting and all that. But maybe he'd be a good person for me to talk to you about forestry and that. Yeah. He's also a deer hunter, so
yeah. That's a good.
I don't know. He works for the DNR, I think. But.
Yeah, finding a forester that's also a deer hunter is key, because if you get someone that's strictly timber production, you're going to get a different answer on some things versus a guy that understands deer hunting too, because it is a little bit two different practices.
Yeah, yeah. Jake, man, I know you got a call around 10, don't you? Your time? Yeah,
tentatively, yes. Yep.
Okay. Well, I won't hold you much longer. I wanted to ask you, though, your story about how you got involved with Exodus, because I think it's a cool story, and you kind of started from the sleeping the floors in the warehouse.
Yeah, right. Yeah, man. So the condensed,
not getting paid for it, probably. No. Right.
The condensed version was I wrote for a website called Wide Open Spaces, and I wrote a bunch of articles, like I think over 700 during college, and that helped me pay through my way through school. And there, I mean, I think the last, before I stopped, I had over 6 million page views on blogs, which is that's a lot.
Wow.
That's a lot. And my 2 seconds of fame is Joe Rogan actually pulled up one of my articles. He's like, Jamie, pull that article up. And it was actually one that I wrote. And I was like, wow, that's crazy.
You know? No way.
Yeah, I swear. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. But
that's
anyways,
where all your 6 million views came from.
Probably, yeah. Right. And and so, you know, during that process, I remember coming across Exodus right when they're getting started. And like, they're going to have a superior product, a 5-year warranty, theft and damage coverage. And I'm thinking, wow, that is really cool. That's crazy. And just sent a cold email. And I remember doing an article on them launching their first camera and stayed in touch. And then as I was getting ready to graduate college, I had to have an internship to graduate. That was the last semester of school. And I basically said, hey, I'll work for free. I don't care, whatever the case may be. And so I was their first like outside employee. I was just an intern, and we did all the trade shows and I did a bunch of the marketing. And as time went on, I was able to buy part of the company and become a co-owner. And I've been an Exodus my whole entire professional career, which is crazy, but started as an intern, doing a little bit of everything, and still do a little bit of everything now today. But it's been a crazy ride. And I think anyone that's looking to get into the outdoor industry, I would say an internship is probably your best route to go in there and work and try to provide value. And I mean, I think a lot of people of our generation, I'll say, that are in the space started as an intern, more than likely. So I think that's the best way to get in.
Yeah. Yep. And most of them from Midwest whitetail.
Yeah, that's an incubator, man.
Like everybody,
everyone. Yeah, everyone was a Midwest whitetail intern. That's in the industry today.
I mean, I was essentially an intern for Dan Infault. I mean, that's
right.
You know.
Yeah.
So, it is kind of crazy. You got to do something for free for a while to get where you want to be. You know, gain some experience, learn some things. So
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So. Man, I appreciate you coming on, and everybody go check out the Land Podcast, Exodus. They're always in the description below. So is there anything else to follow you guys on, Jake?
What's that?
Is there anything else you need to pitch or anything? Oh, we didn't talk about the new camera. Let's talk about that real quick.
Yeah, that's super exciting. We just launched. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, we
had a live last night. I tuned in for most of it.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Yeah, we just launched the Lift 4K, which has been a project we've been working on for a very long time. And this thing is a beast of a non-cell camera. I hate calling it a standard camera because it is nothing but standard. It has dual lens, dual image sensor, shoots native 4K video, really breathtaking images, and just the battery supply. So instead of buying AA batteries, lithium batteries that are $24 a pop, you can buy 6 18650 batteries and you will save $200 over 5 years just in batteries, which is if you use which you have your own code, the BFE4K, you can buy the Lift 4K for $199 and it'll pay for, the battery savings will pay for itself with the camera. So we have that full live stream and dive into all the details. It's kind of a complex product. And it's live on the website too. So we're really excited and proud of it. And it's the next generation of the Lift series, which was what birthed Exodus in 2015. And here we are today. So it's really exciting.
Yeah, it seems like a cool product. And the battery thing is very intriguing to me. Like you said, I think you guys said last night, it's kind of crazy that you guys were the first ones to do it on the market. Yeah. So, I mean, essentially those batteries, they are rechargeable, right? Those,
yes.
Or you can get rechargeable ones.
They're all rechargeable. Okay. So you buy one set and
yeah,
battery life on the cameras. I mean, you buy one set of batteries, run it all year. When you take your camera down, charge them up and put it back out next year. And I mean, I'm sure it's the same thing for you. Buying batteries in the summer or in the fall, it adds up, man. Oh, when you run 10, 20, 30 cameras and just to have buy batteries once and be done. Oh my gosh, that's the way to go.
Yeah, for sure. It seems like a good product and an innovative product too. Something different.
Yeah,
you know, you get a little monotonous with some of these hunting products. It's just like the same crap, different, you know, body
that's
or different.
Why it took us so long to do it
or something.
Yeah, it took us a long time.
Right,
because it is a first of its kind in a couple different categories. But we're really excited. It'll ship later this summer, but it's available right now for pre-order.
Awesome, everybody, go check out the Land Podcast, Trail Cam Radio, subscribe to the Exodus YouTube channel if you haven't yet. So thanks, dude.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Have a good one, everybody. Have a good rest of your Friday and a good weekend. Bye. All right. We are.